about your critics in Moscow and about the weaknesses of the Western nations' law enforcement efforts.
You have my ear, the mafia leader acknowledged.
I know where your rival organization, the Soltsevskaya Gang, is exposed, and I know which members of your organization are working with the FBI and CIA.
Zharkov spoke without shifting his eyes from Gray.
Order some breakfast for our friend here.
One of his men nodded in response and swiftly left the room.
Go on, Oliver.
The shift to his given name was not lost on the wayward spy. A hearty breakfast was rolled into the room by one of Zharkov's bodyguards within minutes, the waiter having been stopped and searched by the security men in the hallway. Zharkov took only coffee for himself, but an impressive spread of vegetables, cold meats, eggs, and pastries was presented to the famished CIA man. Gray ate quickly and drained the Bloody Mary as soon as he realized that it contained more than tomato juice. Zharkov ordered his bodyguards to keep the drinks flowing. When Gray put down his fork and took a breath, Zharkov continued the conversation.
You've promised much, Oliver, and am willing to pay a fair price for the kind of information you claim to have. My father was a grain buyer when the communists were in power. He could have rubber-stamped the purchases, but he took pride in his work and only bought the best crops. He demanded a sample from every bushel that he could inspect. I need a morsel, Oliver, a sample of your wares.
Gray was prepared for the challenge. I understand, Pakhan. I have information on Melor Sokolov of the Soltsevskaya Gang. Despite appearances, he is a homosexual.
Interesting.
He's a suka, too. A bitch.
As much as that kind of behavior disgusts me, Oliver, men who have been in prison do such things. This is not shocking.
I agree, Pakhan, but the man who puts him on his belly is a flight attendant for Air France. He is also an asset of DGSE. He's French intelligence. They know every move that the Soltsevskaya Gang makes and report much of it to the U.S.
Now that, Oliver, is fascinating, Zharkov confirmed.
I believe in long-term relationships, Pakhan.
As do I, Oliver.
I would like to become a permanent asset to you, to your organization. Zharkov's bushy gray eyebrows arched upward before his eyes followed them to the ceiling, considering the proposal.
I must ask you, Oliver, and I hope that you will forgive me for being direct. How can I be assured that you will not betray me the way you betrayed the Americans? How can I know that this is not an elaborate ruse to put a mole inside my business?
Oliver was prepared for this as well. I will not betray you because I am Russian. My mother was Russian. My grandparents who raised me were Russian. My soul is Russian. No, I will not betray you, Pakhan. Besides, where else would I go? Zharkov stared at Gray for a long moment, his eyes studying him for any hint of deception. There was no blink, no darting of the eyes, no twitch of the tiny facial muscles. Nothing.
What do you propose?
Just a fair stipend and an apartment with a view. Zharkov considered the proposition.
20 million rubles a year and a comfortable flat in one of my buildings where you will be safe.
Gray would have taken less, but didn't want to seem overly eager. 20 million rubles was roughly $300,000 U.S. Not bad for a wanted man. That is very generous of you, Pakhan. But there is one other thing.
Which is?
I want a man dead. Chapter 4. Kumba Ranch, Flathead Valley, Montana.
Reese settled into the cabin and put what few possessions he had into the bedroom's dresser drawers and closet. He was struck by how quiet it was. He liked it. There was no television, Wi-Fi, or cell service. The Hastings family used two-way radios to communicate on the ranch, as they were the only reliable means of staying in touch. Repeater stations placed upon various peaks and ridges ensured that one was usually in range. He opened the French doors that led toward the lake and walked toward the shoreline in the crisp, clean air. There were a pair of Adirondack chairs near a stone fire ring just feet from the water's edge. Reese took a seat and admired the view. Who would occupy the other? His pregnant wife, Lauren, and their daughter, Lucy, had been gone for almost 2 years now, murdered in their home as part of the cover-up of a deep state medical experiment gone wrong. Avenging their deaths had brought him closure. Or had it? His mission accomplished, what he hadn't expected, was to live. He'd thought he was dying, a tumor slowly killing him from within. He had counted on joining his wife and daughter in the afterlife. Africa had taught Reese to live again, but the agency had tracked him down in Mozambique, sending his old sniper school partner, Freddie Strain, to recruit him. The carrot was that he could have his life back. The stick was that those who had helped him would go down. Reese chose the carrot. He had done what was asked of him. He'd killed the terrorist leader whose attacks had put the continent of Europe under siege, as well as the former GRU colonel who had masterminded the campaign of terror in an attempt to pave the way for his triumphant return to lead Russia back from the brink. Freddie had died, saving the life of the President of the United States, taken by a sniper's bullet, a sniper who still walked free, a sniper Reese planned to kill. Reese would find him and the CIA mole who had provided the intelligence for the operation. In time, both would die. His debt to America having been paid following the events in Odessa, Reese's new boss at the CIA, Vic Rodriguez, provided a safe house in Annapolis that Reese could use while he prepared for and recovered from surgery. Vic was slowly turning up the pressure, continuing his personal recruitment efforts on the former SEAL, who remained noncommittal. Reese's friend, Katie Baranek, was like a guardian angel. She'd been by his side as he was wheeled into surgery and stood vigil while he recovered. She lived nearby in Old Town Alexandria. There she could work the D.C. Fox News desk and commute to their New York headquarters. It also allowed them to pick up where their friendship had left off. She had helped him unravel the conspiracy that launched him on his mission of vengeance, and she had paid the price, almost losing her life in the process. Unbeknownst to the former frogman, the tough young journalist had questions she needed answered. In matters of the heart, trust was paramount. Snow was falling on a morning when Katie came to see Reese after one of his physical therapy sessions. He was only a week out from surgery and would soon be leaving for Montana. Katie knew that Reese had a continued affiliation with the darkest side of the U.S. intelligence apparatus, though she hadn't probed. She'd seen a man she recognized as the head of the CIA's Special Activities Division with Reese's doctor at Walter Reed. As a journalist, and with her family's history with the agency during the Cold War, she was not a believer in coincidence. She also knew there was a place Reese needed to visit before he left for the mountains. Reese accepted their destination in silent resignation. It was time to say goodbye to someone. Katie drove south, crossing the Potomac River and traversed from Interstate 495 onto George Washington Memorial Parkway. The road wound through leafless oaks, the tall, modern skyline of Rosslyn, Virginia, visible through the frosted passenger side window. Pierre L'Enfant's iconic neoclassical tribute to the Republic across the river to the left. Reese never tired of seeing America's symbols of freedom, the Capitol Dome, the Washington Monument, and the Lincoln Memorial. Planes on final approach to Reagan National Airport roared overhead as Katie exited GW Parkway and steered her Forerunner through a plowed asphalt path that would have, at one point, been in Robert E. Lee's front yard. Reese had been a casket bearer for too many funerals at Arlington National Cemetery over the years, consequences of a life at war. Katie pulled her SUV curbside on Pershing Drive and shut off the motor. Reese let her lead the way. Neither spoke. He knew where they were going. The sound of their footsteps in the freshly fallen snow was a haunting reminder that beneath this hallowed ground rested generations of America's bravest warriors. Reese paused among the granite headstones in silent recognition at the grave of Johnny Mike Spann, the CIA officer killed by Al-Qaeda at Kale Ijangi in Afghanistan. The Alabama native had been the first American to die in combat during the War on Terror. In the nearly two decades since, he had been joined by a legion of heroes who had given their last full measure for the nation. Reese turned and looked toward Katie. She stood to the side of two headstones on the oak-shaded hillside. Reese approached and bowed his head at his father's final resting place. Thomas Reese, Jr., Master Chief Petty Officer, U.S. Navy, SEAL Team 2, May 12, 1946, July 9, 2003, Vietnam, Cold War, Navy Cross. Reese had visited his father's grave only once since the funeral in 2003. He could hardly believe it had been that long since he'd lost the old warrior. He pushed the mystery surrounding his father's death to the side and slowly turned his head to read the marker just beside it, a newer slab of granite stabbed into the cold ground. Judith Francis Reese, March 2, 1951, April 24, 2018. Devoted wife, mother. Despite the cold, Reese's entire body flushed with warmth. He fought back tears as he knelt in front of the stone tribute, a lifetime summed up by a few simple lines. His mother had suffered from dementia for several years and had lived her life in an Arizona nursing home after his father's death. Reese had, in many ways, mourned her since the cruel disease had robbed her memory. He had secretly held out hope that some miracle treatment could bring her back to him. Now she was gone forever, back at his father's side. He treasured his last visit with her when, in a moment of lucidity, she'd recognized her only son, reminding him of Gideon's mission in Judges.
"You've always been one of the few, James. Keep watching the horizon."
Reese closed his eyes and whispered a silent prayer, asking his late mother and father to take care of his wife and daughter until he got there to take the watch.
"I love you."
He wiped his eyes on his sleeve as he rose to his feet and felt Katie's gloved hand slip inside the crook of his elbow.
"I'm sorry, James,"
was all she said, before turning to walk toward her waiting vehicle. Chapter 5. Central African Republic. The trip to the Ukrainian mines in the Christian-controlled district of Bakuma involved a two-hour flight east in the King Air turboprop. Two matching planes carried the envoy at 265 miles per hour toward their destination. Alexander had never hunted in CAR. Poaching and years of civil strife had decimated the game population, though he had hunted the jungles of neighboring Cameroon for bongo, sitatunga, duikers, and the elusive dwarf forest buffalo. He briefly entertained the thought of going after a giant forest hog while he was in the area, but the prospect of another rare game animal for his trophy room didn't excite him as it had in his youth. Now he required something more. Alexander admired the rugged beauty of the African landscape. From the air, it was easy to dismiss the reality on the ground, a place where the people had yet to progress past the foundation of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. 1,000 feet below, malaria remained the leading cause of death, Sanitary drinking water was scarce. Accusations of witchcraft resulted in mob justice. HIV/AIDS affected at least 5% of the population, and women not only suffered the highest percentage of genital mutilation in the world, but also endured one of the highest maternal mortality rates. The Central African Republic was not kind to its people. Outside the few cities, the country remained embroiled in civil war, with 14 separate factions of Muslim Seleka and Christian anti-Balaka militias still vying for contested areas and set on wiping the others from existence. Ethnic cleansing in Africa was the default setting of strife, one that tended to turn on the swing of the machete. The two turboprops touched down on a small dirt strip and taxied to the mine administration building. Under the watchful eye of no fewer than 50 armed Russian soldiers, groups of men labored in the sun, extending the runway and constructing additional infrastructure to accommodate the ongoing rape of natural resources. Alexander noted the handful of local militia who were clearly outmanned and outgunned by their Russian advisors.
"We will see two mines today, Director Zharkov. We will start with the uranium mines and then move to the diamond mines as you requested."
"Da,"
Alexander nodded, his mind working through the possibilities. The Toyota Land Cruisers they were being shuttled in were a far cry from the newer, armored Hiluxes they'd used in the capital, but their low torque and unmatched reliability made them the vehicle of choice, this far from civilization. Even with the windows down, Dobrynin's suit was soaked with sweat, and Alexander wondered why the diplomat insisted on clinging to the formal trappings of Mother Russia. No matter. Alexander just needed to tour the operations, make his decision, then issue his directive. Their three-vehicle convoy was led by a camouflage Peugeot P4 manned by two of the Russian advisors and one of the local militia leaders. Based on the venerable Mercedes G-Wagon, the P4 was the French version of a Jeep. Alexander smiled, knowing Peugeot did not have an export agreement with Mercedes.
"Never trust the French."
Trailing the convoy was an olive-drab Renault troop carrier with 8 local militia members and 4 additional Russian troops. As they maneuvered the rutted roads toward the mines, Alexander noticed young men and boys turn away, ducking behind corners as the envoy passed. The counterinsurgency tactics of the Spetsnaz were working. Fear reigned supreme. They sped through local villages as quickly as the low-torqued machines allowed, the front and rear vehicles bristling with overt weapons. The message was clear: do not fuck with this convoy. The poverty was not shocking to Alexander. Thatched roofs, the occasional malnourished cow, dirty ditches oozing with excrement, and old men and women hovering near death in the dirty streets. As in developing countries the world over, the only smiles belonged to the children playing in the grime. The uranium mine radiated destitution. The workers that Alexander observed lining up to enter the shafts looked like zombies. Even children had been consigned as forced labor, the cost of a village overrun by HIV and AIDS. As the raw ore was raised by hand in wooden buckets or pushed on a crude railway in rickety carts, it was heaped outside the entrance in large piles. Alexander was cautioned to stay on the observation platform, as the radiation level was toxic closer to the piles of ore.
"What's their life expectancy?"
Alexander asked his host, observing the workers covered in boils and blisters.
"Less than a year," Dobrynin confirmed. "Luckily, conscript labor is not a rare commodity in this part of Africa."
It reminded Alexander of the corrective labor camps, what the West insisted on calling gulags after Solzhenitsyn received the Nobel Prize in Literature for his The Gulag Archipelago. Solzhenitsyn was right about one thing. The prisoners were given the opportunity to work to death.
"I've seen enough. Take me to the diamond mines."
The convoy continued another 2 hours as they pushed deeper into the hills, the vehicles making slower progress. Alexander wondered if the reporters who had disappeared a few months earlier were killed because they ran into the wrong militia or were targeted by Spetsnaz for asking too many questions about the mines. No matter. What did they expect, poking around in what amounted to a war zone in Central Africa? A large white man who Alexander deduced to be from the Ural Mountains greeted them at the vehicles, shaking hands and introducing himself as Krisov Petrovich.
Comrade Petrovich runs the mining operation. In the past 7 months, he has turned this into the most efficient and profitable diamond mining operation in the country,
Dobrynin declared. Petrovich wiped his sweaty forehead with a dirty rag and stuffed it back in his pocket. Alexander noticed Dobrynin fish a bottle of hand sanitizer out of his suit pocket and squeeze a liberal amount into his palm.
The workers are paid a generous sum for their labor. Generous for this part of the world, anyway, he continued.
And theft? Is that a problem, or are the wages enough to counter the temptation?
Alexander asked.
Theft will always be a problem, Mr. Zharkov, Petrovich said. We have the unfortunate task of using unorthodox methods to deal with thieves. Come.
Petrovich led the way to what Alexander assumed to be roughly the center of the above-ground operation.
These ungrateful savages still swallow raw diamonds to smuggle them out to sell on the black market. Every few months we need to remind the rest what happens to those who steal.
Alexander watched as 30 workers exited the mine, filthy and thin, their eyes darting about like cornered animals. Desperate. Russian troops lined them up and shackled them to a rail, obviously put there for this very reason. Each of the chained men was given a liter of a magnesium sulfate solution to drink, the equivalent of a medical bowel prep. Within 20 minutes, violent cramps preceded an eruption of watery human excrement. 3 were found to have expelled the raw stones after the local guards sifted through the malodorous mess.
What will happen to them? Alexander asked as the 3 offenders were led away. It's best if we show you, Petrovich replied. In the meantime, follow me.
Alexander took the guided tour, though he listened respectfully to the briefing on diamond mine production and expected output for the coming year. His mind was on the 3 men who had been removed for stealing. They looked fit enough, and living in this area meant they should have tracking and hunting skills.
Ideal candidates.
At the end of the shift, the entire workforce was assembled a few hundred yards away from the mine entrance, at the edge of a pit. They were addressed in their native dialect by the local militia leader, under direct supervision of a Russian advisor. Alexander noted the quiet gloom that fell over the crowd. Death was in the air.
What did he say?
Alexander asked.
He said this is what happens to thieves. Who are they?
Alexander asked, pointing to 3 people lined up across the pit from the gathered crowd. A woman who appeared to be in her 30s, an old man, and a boy who could not have been much more than 10. Their hands and feet were bound, and one leg was secured via chain to rusting chunks of metal. They were naked.
Those are relatives of the 3 pilferers. The militia pulled them from the villages. This is the only language these barbarians understand.
The crowd started to protest and were silenced by a burst of automatic fire from a Russian advisor's AK fired skyward. Alexander watched as a beat-up pickup truck was backed through the crowd, the 3 diamond thieves shackled, naked, to its bed. When they saw their relatives at the edge of the pit, their primal screams pierced the air, arms tugging in a futile attempt to break free.
Quite the deterrent, Dobrynin stated.
Da, unpleasant but necessary, responded Petrovich.
Alexander remained unfazed, even as three guards climbed into the truck, grabbing the heads of the shackled prisoners and forcing them to watch their relatives across the pit be beaten with clubs until they could no longer resist. The woman was the strongest. It took several clubs to the head before her will to fight subsided enough for the men to pick up the heavy metal objects to which they were shackled and throw them into the pit. The Dorylas, better known as safari ants, are found primarily in Central and East Africa. Living in 20 million-strong colonies, they typically move from food source to food source throughout the year. These particular ants were fed well by design. They had no need to move. Their sting is incredibly painful, but the ants seldom use it. Their jaws are strong enough to tear through the flesh of their prey. Indigenous people use them to close cuts that would require stitches in the developed world. Here, in the African bush, they would force the ant to bite on either side of a wound, breaking off the body and leaving the powerful mandibles in place to create a makeshift suture that could close the cut for days at a time. The three thieves were forced to watch their loved ones thrash helplessly about on the floor of the pit, the ravenous safari ants quickly covering their bodies. With no way to swat them off, and anchored to the pit with what amounted to a ball and shackle, they endured the torture of being eaten alive. The old man's heart gave out well before the ants found their way into his brain through his eye sockets. The woman was lucky. She was all but brain dead from her clubbing before she hit the bottom of the pit. The boy, though. The boy's screams would haunt the crowd for the remainder of their lives. His high-pitched cries lasting over 20 minutes as he was slowly eaten by the insatiable insects. When his screams turned to a whimper and finally ended, the three thieves were shackled to iron balls that were then thrown into the pit, where they endured the same slow deaths as their relatives. Within minutes, the three workers were covered with ants. Vain attempts to pull the shackles off amid primal screams and groans filled the evening air. Death took 20 minutes. Within an hour, bones were all that remained.
"That should keep them in line for another month," Petrovich stated.
"Do you have any other questions?"
Dobrynin asked his guest. Alexander shook his head.
"Yes. The diamond mines would be perfect."
Of those scheduled for execution for smuggling the precious stones, Petrovich could keep one every now and then to feed to the ants as a warning. Those of sound mind and body would be airlifted to Alexander in Kamchatka and then on to Medney Island. There, they would at least have a sporting chance. Chapter 6. Old Town, Alexandria, Virginia. Katie Baranek leaned against the wall of her old town condo, lost in thought, watching the raindrops hit the window and slide down to pool on the ledge. She cradled a glass of white wine in one hand while rubbing the cross around her neck with the other. She should have been contemplating her next move at the network. Did she want her own show, or was she content to investigate the stories that interested her, ones she believed were of importance to the American people? Instead, she was thinking of Reese, recovering in Montana, and coming to terms with a future he thought didn't exist. Was she a part of that equation? Would he forever be haunted by visions of his wife and daughter, taken from him by a consortium of politicians, military officers, and private sector financiers? Or was Reese learning to live with their memory, his life a positive testament to their legacy? Katie's eyes focused on a drop of rain as it hit the glass and trickled down the pane, weaving its way among its relatives, all born of the same gray clouds. Thinking back to Reese's surgery, she felt a tinge of guilt for what she'd done afterwards, but before she could surrender to her feelings, she had needed to know the truth.
Can I see him now?
Katie asked the doctor. It had not been lost on the reporter that establishing a relationship with Reese's female surgeon might allow her access not normally granted to non-family members. She had made sure the doctors had seen her with Reese on each of his visits for updated MRIs, CT scans, X-rays, and pre-op procedures. Looking the part of the devoted girlfriend was intentional. She needed answers.
He's just coming back out from under anesthesia. He'll be a bit groggy, but I know he can have visitors now.
It didn't hurt that Dr. Rosen was a big fan of Katie's book. The surgeon had seen enough soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines come through Bethesda over the years to feel a kinship with them and know how they felt about Benghazi. Katie Baranek's debut non-fiction account, aptly titled The Benghazi Betrayal, pulled back the curtain on what had happened in the lead-up to the 13 hours when a small group of CIA contractors fought for their lives, while politicians half a world away, in no danger of being overrun, could hardly be bothered to respond to requests for reinforcements. The surgeon would not forget one of the SEALs who was killed that day. He was a corpsman she'd had the pleasure of getting to know in this very hospital when he was recovering from wounds sustained in Afghanistan before joining the agency. Katie would get special treatment.
How did it go?
The young reporter asked.
All things considered, I am extremely optimistic. Brain surgery of this type has evolved exponentially in recent years. We had an option to actually do this with a local anesthesia, though we usually do those for tumors situated close to the section of the brain that controls speech. In this case, due to the size and location, we opted for general anesthesia, so he's been out for close to 4 hours now. Any side effects we need to worry about?
Katie asked, deliberately using we.
Well, he might not like his new haircut. We had to shave his head to remove a flap of bone to give us access to the brain to remove the meningioma. Everything is back in place. We'll keep him here tonight, maybe tomorrow, depending on how he does, but he can start light exercise in about 3 weeks and ramp it up to his normal regimen in about 6. Thank you for taking such good care of him. It's our pleasure, Katie. I'd love to be there for him when he wakes up. He's just down the hall. I'll be in to check on him shortly.
Katie slipped her laptop back into a bag and made her way down to the recovery room. She shot a smile at the anesthesiologist as she entered.
Hey, Dr. Port, how's our SEAL doing?
Just bringing him back now, Katie.
Dr. Port was a Katie fan as well. In his off time, he volunteered with the Maryland State Police SWAT team as a medic, so he was well acquainted with the community of law enforcement tactical response units, often made up of military veterans. He was there to ensure nothing went wrong with his newest patient, who had become something of a legend in the small fraternity of special operations.
He'll be dazed for a few minutes as the anesthesia wears off, but we'll be back to his old self in no time. You're welcome to hang out here as long as you'd like. A nurse will be checking periodically, and Dr. Rosen will be in soon to evaluate. I'm sure they told you we will be keeping him overnight for observation, but from what I understand, the surgery was extremely successful.
Thank you, Doctor,
Katie said, touching her hand to her heart.
This is what we do, Katie. Dr. Rosen is one of the best in the world. Reese here was in good hands. I'll be back in a few.
Alone in the room, Katie looked down at the man who had saved her life more than a year ago. Bound and gagged, she remembered being forced to kneel on the floor of the Fisher's Island mansion with strands of explosive debt cord wrapped tightly around her neck. A CIA assassin in the employ of the federal government had pressed the button on a remote detonator connected to the explosive flexible cord. If his finger came off the button, she was dead. She was an insurance policy to ensure Reese did the right thing that night. She was in the room with him now to find out if he had. Young for what she had accomplished thus far as a journalist, her series of stories on the Benghazi fiasco and
The resulting bestseller opened doors and established her as an investigative journalist who would follow the truth, regardless of where it led. That is what she was after today. Truth.
Who was James Reese? She wondered.
Was he a domestic terrorist, as the government had proclaimed when they were desperately trying to find and kill him? A vigilante hell-bent on avenging his murdered wife, daughter, and unborn son? Was he a disgruntled veteran who brought the wars to the home front after the ambush of his SEAL team in the mountains of Afghanistan? Was he her savior? Or would he have blown her head off to avenge his family? Was nothing sacred in that quest, including her? Looking up and down the hall outside his room, she softly closed the door. Taking a seat next to his bed, she took his hand in hers, thumbs gently stroking either side of the IV embedded in his vein. She thought back to that rainy night off the coast of Connecticut. She had been in a state of shock, her face bruised and bloodied, as Reese loaded her aboard a Pilatus aircraft that was to be their extract. She moved up the steps in a daze, her body exhausted, as the adrenaline that had sustained her through the violence of the previous hours subsided. Her mind barely discerned the voices. They sounded muffled, as if she were submerged in water with someone shouting at her from above. It had somehow registered that Reese was not coming with them. As Reese stepped back to close the door, Katie had turned sharply in her seat and snapped out of her trance.
Reese, how did you know Ben didn't have that detonator connected? How did you know he wouldn't blow my head off?
Reese had paused, looked Katie in the eye, and over the sound of the wind, the propeller, and the rain, replied, I didn't, before shutting the door and moving off at a run toward the marina. I didn't. Those words had haunted Katie ever since. She had masked her uncertainty since their reunion, waiting for the right time to conduct this interview. Her father had taught her that trust is the foundation of any relationship. He'd been a spy whose family was extracted from what was then Czechoslovakia by Reese's father. She knew Tom Reese had defied orders to bring them out, and that if he hadn't, her father would have been executed, and she would never have been born. Escaping to the United States in the 1980s, Katie's father had been, and still was, a big Ronald Reagan fan. Trust but verify, he had told his children. Katie intended to verify. Reese stirred. His eyes flittered once, twice, and then opened to take in the vision that was Katie Buranek.
Hey, sailor,
she joked, knowing that even though Reese had spent his entire adult life in the Navy, he would never consider himself a sailor. These days, the Navy plowed through the world's oceans on computer chips powered by nuclear reactors. Wind and sails were of a bygone era.
Katie, you didn't have to wait.
His voice was raspy from the breathing tubes that had kept him alive during the almost 4-hour surgery.
But I'm glad you did,
he added with a smile.
Well, the anesthesiologist is kind of cute, so...
Now was the moment of truth. Having a father who had passed medical information to the Americans on top Czech party officials in the name of freedom meant she was well versed in the worlds of medicine and espionage. Katie had listened and learned. Witnessing the Warsaw Pact's response to the Prague Spring in 1968, a young Dr. Buranek decided he did not want his family to live as he had under the iron fist of Soviet bloc repression. The winds of change had started to blow. His position as a physician and surgeon for the party elite gave him access to medical records and sometimes put him in a position to ask certain questions after a surgery as his patients emerged from the fog of general anesthesia. The post-anesthesia phase, when they were uninhibited, was the time to elicit key pieces of information of interest to the CIA. Party officials were always guarded during medical procedures, but per human nature, the thugs in dark suits would occasionally slip up and turn away to flirt with a nurse, sneak a cigarette, or go to the bathroom. That
was when Katie's father would work in a question passed to him by the Central Intelligence Agency. Rhys was in that same phase of the post-op drug sequence, though since the introduction of Versed fentanyl in 1990, the effects were even more dramatic. Sometimes called truth serum, Versed fentanyl was used for pain control and sedation in post-op, a time when Rhys would be most vulnerable and susceptible to questioning. Fentanyl was an opioid painkiller, while the Versed was an amnesiac sedative that left a target ripe for an exploitation they would never remember. A controlled amnesia. Of course, Katie could have just asked Rhys over a dinner in Georgetown, but then she remembered his eyes that night on Fisher's Island as he fired 4 rounds into Ben Edwards' face. They were ice cold. No remorse. She needed to know with absolute certainty, and the truth serum provided her the opportunity she needed. Katie knew the clock was ticking. With every second that went by, the effects of the drugs would lessen. It was now or never. Rhys, Katie inquired as naturally as possible, as if she were asking where he wanted to go for lunch.
When we were on Fisher's Island, I asked you how you knew Ben didn't have the detonator connected to the explosives around my neck. Do you remember that?
Rhys's smile faded. He closed his eyes and nodded his head.
Stay with me, Rhys,
she continued in her most soothing voice, continuing to stroke his hand.
Did you know it wasn't connected?
Rhys's eyes stayed closed, and Katie was worried he had drifted off.
Damn it, this is my only chance. Rhys, did you think it was connected?
Katie pressed. I knew, Rhys said, opening his eyes to look into hers before closing them again.
Shit, rookie move. Which question was he answering? Did he know or not?
Katie's head snapped toward the door at the sound of approaching voices.
Shit.
They'd be at the room any moment. She had to know.
She just needed a few more seconds.
Spinning in her chair, she looked for a way to lock the door.
Nothing. Are you kidding me?
Frantically, she scanned the room. She had been with her father in enough hospitals to know that, as high occupancy facilities, the doors were all required to be auto-closing. However, the fire code and the practical necessities of efficiently running a hospital were often at odds. In violation of the fire code, auto-closing doors had to be kept manually open so doctors and nurses could move up and down the halls checking on patients. Seeing a rubber door stop, she grabbed it and shoved it under the door, kicking it securely in place before once again taking up her position at Rhys's bedside.
You knew what, Rhys?
She asked, switching back to a calm, inquisitive tone. Rhys murmured something almost inaudible.
What?
She asked, leaning in closer.
I knew it wasn't connected.
Katie's body visibly trembled. All the months of pent-up wonder and doubt were answered through the side effects of narcotically induced slumber. She heard a hand shaking the doorknob, followed by the concerned voice of the nurse.
Excuse me! Excuse me!
She heard from the hallway.
Just a few more questions. Damn it! Rhys, how did you know?
Nothing.
How did you know, Rhys?
Katie pressed on, now hearing another set of hands rapping urgently on the doorframe, and knowing she had only a scant few moments before Rhys emerged from his haze. In a whisper, Rhys answered through the drugs.
Ben was standing too close. The blasting cap, the petin, and the det cord, he was too close.
The knocks were now joined by another voice at the door. She would not get another chance, so she pressed on, ignoring what now must have been causing a scene in the hallway.
Rhys,
Katie continued with a bit more urgency in her voice,
why did you say that night on Fisher's that you didn't know? Why did you make me think that all these months?
Still in the land between dreams and reality, the Versed fentanyl lowering inhibitions to a level where, no matter the answer, all would be right with the world, Rhys responded truthfully.
I didn't want you waiting on me, Katie. I was going to die that night, and I didn't want you to feel loss the way I had.
Katie gulped, her eyes misting over. suddenly aware of a tightening in her chest. Suddenly aware again of the banging outside, she rose and gracefully crossed the room, opening the door to the concerned faces of Dr. Rosen, Dr. Port, the nurse, and a security guard.
"I am so sorry. We just needed some privacy." "Ms. Baranek, you can't block the door to the room," a clearly agitated Dr. Rosen lectured,
as she and Dr. Port moved to Reese's side to check the monitors attached via wires and tubes to his body. Putting on her most demure and apologetic smile, Katie lowered her head.
"I really do apologize. I just did not want a special moment interrupted."
"It's okay, Doc,"
Reese said groggily, struggling to push himself up to his elbows.
"We had to discuss something here in the skiff."
Dr. Rosen's demeanor softened.
"Well, don't do that again, Frogman, or I'll have you keel-hauled."
"Aye, aye, Doc,"
Reese smiled, attempting to raise his hand in salute, but only managing to lift it a few inches off the bed.
"It's okay,"
Dr. Rosen assured the security guard, who didn't know quite what to do in the presence of the cable news personality and the man whose face had been plastered on televisions and newspapers across the country just over a year ago.
"I'll take it from here."
"Yes, ma'am," he replied, walking back into the hall.
"You just rest up, Commander,"
the doctor said, switching into military mode. "Katie, you can stay here with him if you'd like. Just promise me you will not bar the door again, no matter what powers of persuasion he attempts to exert."
"I'll be on my guard."
As Dr. Port injected a microdose of narcotic into Reese's IV to assist with the transition out of his dream state, Dr. Rosen turned to Katie.
"He'll be up and walking around in a few hours, if you can believe that. He's going to be fine." "Thank you, Doctor."
Moving toward the hallway with Dr. Port, the surgeon stopped and turned back toward Katie, who had again taken up residence at Reese's side.
"I hope you got the answer you were looking for, Miss Baranek."
Not taking her eyes off the frogman who had appeared to drift back to sleep, Katie replied,
"I did."
Alone again in the recovery room, Katie wondered if Reese remembered her questions. If so, she knew that memory would soon dissolve, along with the remaining mixture of Versed fentanyl.
"Rest up, James. I'll be here when you wake up."
Chapter 7. SVR Headquarters, Moscow. Alexander Zharkov wasn't sure what his father was up to, but as the deputy director of Directorate S in the nation's Foreign Intelligence Service, his ability to assist him was substantial. That was the entire reason he held the post, to be the eyes and ears of the Bratva. Directorate S was responsible for the illegal intelligence operations of the former KGB, deploying strategic long-term deep cover operatives into foreign countries. They were more commonly referred to as sleeper agents. He commanded the nation's most effective assassins. Alexander knew that citizens of the West were getting soft. Most of them believed the Red threat had ended with the collapse of the Soviet Union and that Russian spies were now only found in 80s movies. The truth was that the SVR had more sleeper agents embedded throughout the United States and Europe than they ever had during the Cold War. The open borders of the European Union and America's current obsession with terrorism left them vulnerable for penetration. They remained blind even when sleeper cells were activated to kill Ukrainian military intelligence officers in 2017, a former employee of the current Russian president on the streets of Washington, D.C. in 2015, and almost one person a year in Great Britain since the beginning of the decade. Unlike traditional intelligence officers, illegals lived a complete lie. Instead of operating under a semi-legitimate cover for status position, usually a job at the embassy or consulate, illegals had to enter a nation with little aid from their own government and blend into their new country. Alexander knew he would have been a brilliant illegal because he had mastered the lie. He could do it without the slightest hint of remorse. As was his father's wish, he had run illegals at postings across the world, and his success had driven him rapidly up the ranks of director at S, eventually landing him back in Russia in a position to pass intelligence to the family business. Alexander could create virtually bulletproof false identities, as well as produce legitimate Russian Federation passports to match them. For someone trying to smuggle a person across international borders, Alexander Zharkov could work magic. A posting in the intelligence world might seem like a strange place for the son of a mafia boss, but in Russia, as Alexander knew, there was a long history of associations between the government and organized crime that predated their Sicilian counterparts by almost a century. From the Tsars to Stalinist Russia through the waning days of the Soviet Union and into the heyday after the fall, the Red Mafia was embedded in almost all facets of state affairs. The Bratva was not an outside criminal threat, but rather part of the government itself. When Stalin betrayed his criminal ties during the Great Purge, he inadvertently created an even stronger organization that had survived and thrived to this day. What might raise eyebrows in other parts of the world was business as usual for the Russian Federation. Alexander was simply continuing the tradition. The director had what he described as a functional relationship with his mob boss father, but there was an underlying rift between them that went beyond the traditional father-son power struggle, a chasm that developed when Alexander was still a boy. Ivan had insisted that his eldest son pursue a career in the nation's intelligence services, a career that would surely pay dividends for his father's business interests. Alexander had sacrificed his entire adult life climbing the ladder of the SVR, a ladder that had led him through countless third-world hellholes, places where not too many questions were asked when a man went missing. Meanwhile, his two younger brothers lived the good life, chasing women, driving fast cars, and putting coke up their noses in Paris, London, New York, and Miami. His father promised him that in the long run he would be the Pakhan, and his brothers would be his lieutenants. Yet, year after year, his brothers rose in influence, building their own networks. Alexander knew that he was too valuable to his father in his current position to leave, and that his younger siblings at this point would not let him simply walk in and take what they now considered theirs. Alexander felt the pull born of a primal instinct from a time when people lacked the ability to reason, when they were no different from every other animal roaming the earth. Civilization was a more recent introduction to the evolution of the species. Despite that thin veneer, instinct still requires the young bull to exert his dominance over the herd. That time was approaching for the Zharkov line, and Alexander would soon make his move. Chapter 8. St. Petersburg, Russia. 700 kilometers to the northwest, Ivan Zharkov had left Oliver Gray in the suite, giving him a chance to bathe, rest, and recover from his travels. Prostitution was one of the Bratva's primary rackets, and the mafia boss had offered Gray a woman for the night. Upon Gray's refusal, Ivan had offered him a man. Gray graciously declined both, which caused some confusion on the part of his host. The embarrassment of Gray's one sexual encounter with a female was an experience that he did not wish to repeat. The vodka left Gray buzzing, but after a long bath in the room's extravagant tub, he felt almost human again. He was beginning to doze when a knock on the door sent a surge of adrenaline through his body. Wrapped in a bathrobe, he peered through the peephole and spied a small, bearded man carrying an attaché case. "Can I help you?"
"I am Lev, the tailor. Pakhan sent me."
Gray breathed a sigh of relief and opened the door. He had half expected to see a tall American holding a suppressed pistol instead of the small, pot-bellied man impeccably dressed in a three-piece suit. The tailor walked into the room without shaking Gray's hand and began to unpack the tools of his trade. Lev insisted that Gray remove the robe and began taking measurements with a physician's disinterest in his stark nudity. Each measurement was entered into a small notebook with a small stub of a pencil. Gray was embarrassed and spoke nervously as the man worked, ignoring his attempts at conversation as though they didn't speak the same language.
"Put on your robe. We need to pick fabrics," Lev said as he snapped the small notebook shut and wrapped it with a thick rubber band.
He spread books of swatches across the bed and motioned for Gray to examine them.
"Mr. Zharkov has generously paid for 3 suits and 5 shirts. I will make you more if you choose, but they will come from your own pocket."
Gray spent close to an hour narrowing his choices, ultimately picking a brown tweed, a charcoal window pane, and a blue chalk line. He didn't want to look like another one of Zharkov's security men. He chose plain, solid shirts that would keep his life simple. He knew better than to tackle the daily challenge of matching his clothes.
"I do not make shoes or ties. For those items, you should go to the passage on Nevsky Prospect. It is not far."
The man looked at the small gold watch on his wrist.
"These items will be ready in 2 days.
He quickly packed his bag, returned his black Homburg to his head, and walked swiftly out the door. It was late afternoon when Gray stepped out of the hotel and began a leisurely half-hour walk toward the city's upscale shopping district. "You are safe here, Oliver. There is no need to worry." Though he had only been to St. Petersburg a handful of times, always on CIA business, he felt strangely at home here. He absorbed the splendor of St. Petersburg as he wound his way through the streets, admiring the intricate Baroque and neoclassical architecture. His path took him on to the Nevsky Prospect and across the narrow Fontanka River via the Anikhov Bridge. He took a small detour to walk the grounds of the Alexandrinsky Theater, filled with mothers watching their bundled-up children playing in the park. Taking a seat on a bench at the edge of the Mikhailovsky Garden, he packed his pipe and tried to relax. The city was alive. It was hard to believe. There was a time, not that long ago, when Russia's cultural capital was almost destroyed by the Axis powers in World War II, back when it went by the name Leningrad. Gray seemed to remember that snipers were somehow associated with the siege. Or was that Stalingrad? The thought of snipers caused Gray to abruptly move from his bench and continue toward his destination. He looked up at the surrounding buildings, half expecting to see James Reese behind a scope. The analyst in him attempted to banish the notion. "Reese could never find me here. I am now protected by the Bratva." Gray crossed the street and walked the remaining block to the passage, an upscale shopping arcade that dated back to the 1840s. As he strolled through the long building, all marble and plaster, peering into the hand-painted plate-glass windows of the various shops, Gray felt transported to a different era. The building was a striking example of Russian prominence with its intricate tile floor, detailed dentil interior trim, and vaulted glass ceiling. Most of the customers displayed noticeable signs of wealth, oversized ornate watches for the men and long furs, high-end handbags, and diamonds for the women. Everyone chatted on iPhones as they shopped. The proceeds of Russia's raw materials, oil, natural gas, gold, copper, and magnesium, extracted by tough, filthy men who drank hard and died young, were converted by the nation's elite into hard currency that flowed through luxury arteries such as this one. Gray's family had always been at the base of this class pyramid, but he was working his way up. He took his time shopping, carefully selecting the ties, socks, underwear, and T-shirts that would comprise his new wardrobe. He completed the ensemble with a frightfully expensive pair of shoes that put a significant dent in his stack of euros. Each vendor made change in rubles, allowing him to accumulate local currency without having to deal with the formality of banks. He found a barbershop and spent some of his new money on a haircut and a beard trim. The heavily tattooed staff were all young men who obviously spent a great deal of time and effort emulating the appearance of American hipsters. It seemed that one could not escape the West's cultural poison even in Mother Russia. Two men lounged on the black pleather couch in the corner, playing a soccer video game on a large LCD television monitor that hung on the exposed brick wall. Gray spoke little, but listened intently, trying to gather as much practical knowledge as possible about his new home. He had done his best to enjoy the day, but an annoying sensation that he couldn't seem to erase continually interrupted his contentment. The vodkas he downed with dinner did nothing to shake his feelings of impending doom. He stumbled more than once in his haste to return to the safety of his hotel, his eyes darting from shadow to shadow and rooftop to rooftop, the specter of James Reese, his constant companion. Chapter 9. Kumba Ranch, Flathead Valley, Montana. Reese cranked the powerful motor on his new cruiser and listened to it hum. He pulled out of the garage and gunned the motor as he turned up the steep grade, testing the vehicle's torque as it climbed. It responded instantly and flew up the gravel track, spitting rocks as it went. He crested the ridge and took it slowly down the switchbacks. No sense flipping his new ride on the first day. He hit the ranch's main road and turned in the direction of the refurbished barn that Rafe used as his workshop, a 20-minute trip by vehicle. The two friends had joined the Navy a year apart, taking separate paths until finally serving together in Ramadi, Iraq, at the height of the war. When their task unit lost two SEALs to a roadside bomb, Rafe went off the reservation, using their tactical HUMINT network to find the IED cell leader responsible, a man named Hakim al-Maliki. He then used that same network to deliver a package to the terrorist after a sanctioned raid to capture him was called off by higher authority. Al-Maliki was a CIA asset, and his value as a long-term penetration agent meant he was off-limits as a target. The device that sent al-Maliki to the afterlife contained a fertilizer-based main charge with commercial detonators from Pakistan, an IED profile common to Ramadi at the time. The CIA was furious, accusing Rafe of killing their prized asset and demanding he be prosecuted. The Navy had not been sure what to do and immediately launched an investigation. Reese was the only person who could identify Rafe as the bomber, and he refused to cooperate with investigators, causing no shortage of consternation between the Navy and the CIA, and between Reese and Rafe. Rafe didn't want to see Reese's reputation tarnished by investigations, and Reese wasn't about to be a witness against his blood brother. Due in no small part to his friend's refusal to provide any useful information to investigators, and out of concern for the damage it could do if the facts of the case became public, Rafe was eventually cleared of the accusation. The CIA, protecting an insurgent responsible for blowing up members of the U.S. military, long-term penetration agent or not, would not play well in the court of public opinion. Wasn't the job of SEALs to kill terrorists? Rafe was removed from theater and assigned to the Naval Special Warfare Cold Weather Warfare Detachment on Kodiak Island in Alaska. There he put his ample outdoor skills to use, training new SEALs to survive and thrive in the austere climate of the North. It was a perfect fit for the adopted son of Montana, but as an officer, he couldn't stay in the job indefinitely. He'd grown tired of watching men and women come home from endless wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, physically and emotionally broken. It was time to move on. When he received orders to move into a staff role down in Coronado, he dropped his papers and resigned his commission. He first took a job in finance, throwing himself into it with the same zeal with which he had attacked all of life's challenges, but he felt suffocated by life in Manhattan. Rafe was rushing to the office one day when he received a text message telling him that his old team chief at Redacted had shot himself in the heart. He'd left a suicide note apologizing to his wife and children and asking that his brain be used to study the effects of traumatic brain injury and PTSD. After 2 weeks in Virginia Beach, assisting the family and attending the memorial and funeral, Rafe decided it was time to go home. As Rafe made the long drive from New York to western Montana, his mind went to work. He needed to find a way to help transition his former teammates into life beyond the fight, a bridge to the next chapter in life. He couldn't just hand them a suit and help them write a resume. They needed to find purpose again. Rafe also examined his own life. A natural loner who thrived in the solitude of the outdoors, Rafe still knew something was missing. Anika Thornton had been his on-again, off-again girlfriend since high school. Their fathers were close friends and adjoining landowners in many of their real estate holdings. It had been Anika's father, Tim, who had encouraged Jonathan Hastings to diversify his cattle earnings into Montana real estate. That move had proven to be vastly more lucrative than ranching. While Rafe chose to attend the University of Montana in Missoula, Anika was accepted to Yale and they drifted apart. When Rafe was based in Virginia Beach and she was in graduate school at Wharton in Philadelphia, their relationship rekindled, and Rafe had nearly proposed. When he received word that he'd earned a coveted slot at Green Team, his personal life was forced to the back burner. Anika took a job in San Francisco, and soon after that, 9/11 hit. Rafe's life was focused on his endless overseas deployments, and hers was spent making her own way in the business world. They kept in touch and reunited whenever their geographic paths crossed. When it came time for her father, Tim Thorne Thornton, to pull back on the reins of life and spend some time away from the business, he was finally able to convince Anika to return to Montana. She was serving as the chief operating officer of a Dallas-based energy firm and on a path to be the company's first female CEO. She had proven to herself and everyone else that she could be successful on her own. No one would doubt her ability to serve as president of the family's vast petroleum and real estate empire. The two childhood sweethearts were finally back in Big Sky Country. The wedding of Tim Thornton's only daughter could have been a lavish affair, the formal joining of two families who were some of Montana's largest and wealthiest landowners. Instead, they opted for more subdued nuptials at Rafe's uncle's hunting operation in Nyasa Game Reserve, Mozambique. When the newlyweds returned from a 3-week honeymoon that took them across South Africa from Cape Town to a private game reserve in the Sabi Sands, Rafe went to work building the next chapter in his life. Both the Hastings and Thornton families had been leasing their land to hunting outfitters for years, and some had been more dedicated than others when it came to managing the natural resources. Rafe built a plan that would sustainably manage the ranch's wildlife while providing a path forward for his fellow special operations veterans. He consolidated all of the leases into a single outfitting business that handled everything from the booking of the clients to the processing and shipping of the meat. There were a surprising number of closet hunters among his associates in the world of New York finance, and thanks to his time spent on Wall Street, he rapidly built a steady stream of clients. Word spread quickly that Rafe delivered a high-quality outdoor experience, and he soon had a waiting list. A hunting operation is only as good as its guides, and that was an area where Rafe was able to differentiate himself from the rest of the industry. He hired the best outdoorsmen he had served with in the military, including several of the instructors from Kodiak. They were hardworking, competent, reliable, and fun to be around. The clients loved them, and they delivered. The guides received a steady stream of income while finding time to take a breath and evaluate their priorities outside the world of special operations. Rafe's goal was to connect successful businessmen, entrepreneurs, and financiers with hardened operators. This created an informal network that became known as Warrior Guardians. Those in the private sector connected to a community of talent that was unprecedented in modern society and that was often shrouded in secrecy. Both groups recognized the value in bridging the divide between those who did the fighting and those who paid for it. And more than a few internships, businesses, foundations, and fresh starts were born under the Montana skies. When the operation began hosting wounded veterans on hunts as part of a foundation funded by successful clients, the guides found even greater purpose. Bonding under the stars, these men and women, many of whom had been grievously injured by